following program is paid for by Barbara Arnwine.
The topics, views, and opinions expressed on the air and via All Igniting Change with Barbara Arnwine, platforms by host Barbara Arnwine Esquire, guests, and supporters are their own and are independent of any organization, entity. Nothing said on the show or any of its platforms constitutes a client-attorney relationship or serves as legal advice, counsel. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to Igniting Change, its platforms, or the show's host. It's time now for Igniting Change, a weekly provocative and empowering program where you, the listener, can ignite change. Now here's your host, Barbara Arnwine. Get up,
stand up. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Igniting Change. Oh, my goodness, do we have a great show for you today. And we are so happy that you have joined us. Yes, good afternoon, East Coast. Good morning, the rest of the country. It is time for some Igniting Change, and we got a show for you. We want to continue to wish everyone celebrating Pride Month a great Pride Month. We want to also say to all of those celebrating Black History Month, great Black History Month, Black Music Month, I should say, the Black Music Month and Black History of Music Month is so important for all of us to celebrate. Listen, folks, we had an incredible panel last night, and it was moderated by our amazing co-host of Igniting Change. You know who I'm talking about. That wonderful, brilliant, innovative, creative genius. Yes, I'm talking about the chair of the board of the Transformative Justice Coalition, one of the nation's foremost civil rights and voting rights lawyers. I'm talking about none other than my co-host, Daryl D. Jones. Hey, Daryl.
Hey, Barbara, it must be Tuesday, Eastern Standard Time, because we're talking about igniting change. And Barbara, you could not be more exacting, could not be more correct than talking about the discussion we had last night YouTube and Facebook and all over the place, where we were discussing democracy on the cliff. And my goodness, the panel that was assembled, the information that was relayed, it was just an incredible, incredible panel discussion. And, you know, we're going to touch on some of it today, but you know, you got to go to the Facebook or to the YouTube and listen to all 90 minutes of that discussion, because it was just so incredibly powerful, Barbara.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to give a shout out to Josh Raby in Alabama and all of the people who he reassembled this morning for a watch party, a second watch party of our program from last night on Democracy at the Cliff. I want to, you know, just give him a huge shout out to all those Gen Zs who were part of that watch party this morning. Just keep it going, folks, because it takes all of us in the struggle to make the change that we must see. And I want to just thank Daryl, those amazing panelists last night. We're going to be joined by two of them today to reprise the highlights of the panel and to make sure that we keep drilling down, because everybody, note, today is the 11th anniversary of the horrific, ugly, destructive, devastating Shelby versus Holder decision that the Roberts Court issued, that basically said that there was no evidence of present discrimination in voting. So they struck down the coverage formula that used to say what states and jurisdictions, some 2,100 of them, had to be covered by, you know, what's called preclearance, that they couldn't be trusted because of their history of racial discrimination in voting. So you have to make sure that they submitted any suggested change in law or procedures for voting. And when that went away, the floodgates opened to these states and jurisdictions to start acting horrific. So we're going to talk about this anniversary, folks, because we got to note it because we can't take it. 11 years. It's time for change. It's time to correct the federal legislation. Right, Daryl?
Absolutely, Barbara. And, you know, for people that want to learn more about the Shelby versus Holder decision, there's going to be a teach-in tonight.
That's right.
Barbara, and that you're going to be moderating. And they're just some of the best legal minds with regards to presenting information, so you can really get a very firm understanding of what the Shelby versus Holder case said, did, and its impact today on voting rights in America.
That's right. And we're going to also be using that opportunity. Me and my co-host, Leslie Pearl, who is the director of democracy at the Mighty Leadership Conference for Civil Rights Under Law, we're going to be talking not only about the Shelby case, which we're about to go into deeply for you on this show, but we're also going to be talking about the corrective legislation, the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, the Native American Voting Rights Act. And you know it, those of you right here in the mighty DMV, D.C. statehood. Oh, we got to talk about all these needed legislation. So we're going to do that tonight. We're going to go through each bill, make sure people know. We're going to talk about the organizing that we're doing for July 17th, which is the fourth anniversary of the passing of John Lewis. And we're going to talk about finishing the job of all these great bills that he was a tremendous advocate for. So with that said, let me bring on our first guest. Ooh, Daryl, we got a guest for this show. She tore it up last night. She set the framework. She anchored the discussion. She got everybody rolling, and I'm talking about the wonderful Professor Maureen Edelbar. She is the author of various law reviews and legal periodicals regarding voting rights in the U.S. Constitution. She is currently an assistant professor of law at Washington Lee University. She's a Delaney Center Fellow there. She teaches and writes constantly in constitutional law, focusing on voting and elections. She's a former policy director and counsel for the Congressional Black Caucus. She's and was a counsel for our beloved Congressman Jamie Raskin on the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and a visiting professor of law at Penn State Law and former staff attorney at the League of Women Voters. And everybody, she is also a Gen Z TJC fellow. Hey, welcome to the show today, Maureen.
Good afternoon, Barbara. It's so great to be here with you again. Thank you for the lovely introduction. And shout out to Daryl for moderating such a powerful town hall last night.
Did he do it? Did he do it? I mean, Daryl is amazing, and that was just awesome. So let's get started, because a lot of people are, you know, saying Shelby versus Holder, Voting Rights Act, horrible case. What does all that mean? Do you want to tell people more about the Shelby case and why this anniversary is something that we must take note of?
Absolutely. So 11 years ago today, June 25th, 2013, the Supreme Court basically disarmed the most effective provision of the Voting Rights Act, preclearance. What preclearance did was it required states that had a terrible, sordid history of racial discrimination in voting to submit any change to their voting policies or laws to the federal government for approval prior to that law being effectuated, to ensure that those laws were not trying to disenfranchise Black voters, young voters, disabled voters, voters with speaking English as a second language. This was a really powerful tool that brought a lot of new voters into the electorate, and I think was integral in bringing America the first Black president. So with every period of progress in American society, there's always a backlash. Shelby represents the backlash. What happened in Shelby was that the court said the coverage formula that was used to determine which states had to ask permission to change their laws was outdated because it was based on data from the 60s and the 70s in some cases. What the court said was that this formula hasn't changed, but America has changed. Look at how many members we have in the Congressional Black Caucus. Look at how diverse our state legislatures are. Look at how many Black people are registered to vote. We don't need this anymore. We are a colorblind country now. Racism is over. So why hold the states to this standard when our electorate looks so much different than it did in 1965? And, you know, what we talked about last night was how Shelby sort of was undergirded by this sort of racial theory that, you know, we have to exculpate the South. We have to exculpate racists, essentially, because making them beg the federal government before they're able to do something is just against the principles of federalism. Why do they have to beg the federal government when other states do not? It's unfair. So the balance is now sort of tipped in favor of runaway rogue state legislatures who are really willing to go above and beyond to disenfranchise voters, banning drop boxes, defying Supreme Court orders to create more Black representation in southern states, banning handing out water and food while you're waiting in line to vote. I mean, it's really, really been quite terrible what happened after Shelby, which is why it's so important to remember on this 11th anniversary how important it is to vote in the election, to vote for a party, vote for a person that will allow you to exercise your right to vote freely, fairly, and equitably.
Well, you know, Maureen, you lay all that out, and, you know, some of the folks are there listening. And they're saying, okay, so they required identification to be able to vote, to be able to get your ballot and be able to vote. If it's required of everybody, I don't see what the problem is what they're saying. How do you respond to that, Maureen?
Well, I would draw everyone's attention to the law Texas passed right after the Shelby decision, which basically allowed you to vote with a gun license, a concealed carry license, but didn't allow you to vote with a student ID, which you could only get if you were, you know, a resident of Texas going or enrolled in a Texas college. So those sorts of laws clearly are designed to target particular demographics who tend to vote in particular ways. So when we're looking at laws that seem very neutral on their face, what's more important is that we examine the motivations of the legislature, and we can do this by simply reading the statement in support of the legislation that they make on their, you know, House floor, but also looking at the effect of the legislation, right? Who is affected disproportionately by this legislation? And largely, it is low-income people, it is naturalized immigrants, it is young people, it is people who do not speak English as the first language, and it is people who are not able-bodied. And so when we're talking about voter ID laws, it's really important to look at the comprehensive scope of the policy. Because while text can certainly be race-neutral and neutral on its face, it never really is in its effect.
And, you know, it's important, everyone, to understand that voter ID is only one of many forms of voter suppression. There, if you go to tjcoalition.org, that is tjcoalition.org, or votingrightsalliance.org, you will find the 72 forms of voter suppression. That includes everything from blocking early voting or limiting it to, you know, just a few days, or not having it, as some states do, at all. Also, it includes, you know, blocking and not having souls to the polls Sundays. It includes all the voter disenfranchisement that exists for those who were formerly incarcerated. It includes, you know, states that don't allow you to, you know, register during, you know, certain times of, you know, primaries, runoffs, et cetera. It includes so many things, folks. You know, you've been hearing about folks being purged off the voter rolls. That's a form of voter suppression. You've been hearing about these challengers going into jurisdictions and challenging 30,000, thousands of people who they have no clue into jurisdictions and challenging 30,000, thousands of people who they have no clue, never met, don't know anything about, but say, but they just put their names on a list and say these people should not be allowed to vote, to try to deny people the right to vote. We have heard about these state legislatures passing these laws saying that you can't give food, water, any kind of a chair for the elderly to sit in while they're waiting in 3-hour lines in the heat. Come on, folks. I mean, these are the things that are happening out there with voter suppression. And as I said, there are 72 plus forms, and every day they're coming up with something new to try to block voters. So it is so incredibly important that people know that we are in a major fight. Now, when you look at that fight, Maureen, you know, since the last presidential election, what are some of the other examples that states have engaged in, including redistricting, to block and make it harder for voters to participate, especially voters of color?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Barbara. I mean, we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic that many states expanded opportunities to vote in unprecedented ways, allowing drive-through voting, allowing ballot drop boxes, allowing widely absentee voting by mail, to make voting safer and more accessible. In the aftermath of that pandemic, which arguably is still going on, states are now taking an about face. What states are doing essentially is severely restricting vote by mail because some legislators and people in power believe that it benefits one party over the other, although there is not statistical evidence to confirm that. States are also rolling back protections for election administrators, making elections more protracted in the sense that they're operating in such a politicized environment, and their volunteers, many of them, are not paid. So they're essentially taking the infrastructure out of election administration and creating an election day environment that is untenable for the voter, which would dissuade the voter from returning to the poll or even waiting in line to cast their ballot. States are also, in some cases, intentionally providing a level of misinformation or confusion regarding how one can register to vote, but also vote. In some localities in Texas, the group, the League of Women Voters, has reported that some postmasters are even not allowing them to place voter registration forms in the post office. So what happened after Shelby is just crescendoing and crescendoing and crescendoing. And the only thing, well, not the only thing, but one of the major things we can really do to stop this is to pass the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. It would end the confusion and intentional misinformation about absentee voting, voting by mail, by setting national standardized rules and procedures. It would require each state to have adequate periods of safe early voting. It would restore and modernize preclearance and ensure less discrimination in voting. It would modernize the voter registration process. And lastly, it would provide states the funding and the equipment that they sorely need to administer and protect our elections.
Wow. And we also,
Maureen.
Yes, go ahead, Darryl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Maureen, we listened to you talk about the, you know, John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and how it just sort of, you know, this was my word, modernizes so that folks know, you know, what the rules are and how they can vote, where they're supposed to vote, when they can vote, and all those things, all those little, you know, technical things, if you will, on how people can access their right to vote and have it protected.
But it all feels pretty much common sense to me. What's the opposition to it?
That's a great question, Daryl. What is the opposition to it, right? This is a democracy. We should want people to vote, right? There, and there's also, again, no evidence that the more people vote, the more left or right the country becomes. If this country is what it says we are, we all should support the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And I would encourage people to just revert back to history for a moment. Let's go back to the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. There was bipartisan support for legislation like the Voting Rights Advancement Act, the Voting Rights Act. There was bipartisan support from some of the most hostile senators from the South. There was support from Ronald Reagan. There was support from George Bush. I mean, voting does not have to be divisive. It does not have to be partisan. The country wins when the majority's will is effectuated, and that's the point of democracy. So why don't people want people to vote? I would say because they are afraid that the majority of people would not support their policy agenda. So instead of the voters picking the politicians want to pick the voters.
And that's what is unacceptable. You know, it's fascinating to me, Maureen. Every time I look at the Shelby case, and I've taught it, you know, over the years, like you are teaching it now. And, you know, and it's so, it's always, you know, it's such a flawed decision, such a dishonest decision. You know, it attempts to reverse everything that the court had said previously in the Kasenbach case. But they wouldn't even admit that that's what they did, that they overruled that case. So there's just so much, you know, that's wrong with this Supreme Court. And we're going to talk more about that Supreme Court, you know, when our next guest arrives, and we're going to go deeper into what in the world is going on with the Supreme Court, but also the federal judiciary. You know, tell people about, you know, this whole attack on the Voting Rights Act itself, because we know that, Justice Thomas has said and written forever about how he thinks the Voting Rights Act should not exist, how it's unconstitutional. But there's been another level of attack now by, 20-plus state attorney generals, mainly from mainly from those Republican, states and why I should say Republican states from Republican state attorney generals who are saying that the Voting Rights Act should not be accessible to everybody. Tell people what happened in this Eighth Circuit ruling and this new case, League of Women Voters versus LaRose, where they're saying the same thing as to people with disability rights. Tell people about the Eighth Circuit decision on private right of action.
Absolutely. This is such an important case to discuss. What's going on in the Eighth Circuit is that essentially plaintiffs, which are private parties, nonprofit groups like the NAACP, have sued a state alleging that the map is racially gerrymandered, meaning that there's not enough representation for the Black and brown people in that state. Instead of looking at the merits of their claim, what the Eighth Circuit did was effectively kick them out of the courthouse. The Eighth Circuit said that they have no legal authority to sue under the Voting Rights Act because the Voting Rights Act does not contain in text what is called a private right of action to enforce the law. Now, what is so jarring about this argument is that first, it is an argument that has been raised since the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. It is an argument that many have tried to use to gut the Voting Rights Act for decades, and it has not been successful because it is a weak argument. And it is weak because when Congress passed and reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, when they assembled witnesses, when they drafted this bill, when they prepared their committee reports,
they indicated in no uncertain terms that private parties and associations, nonprofits, could sue in addition to the Department of Justice. Even more, since the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, over 90% of the cases filed include a private party or nonprofit organization. Those people have enforced the Voting Rights Act more than the Department of Justice. Further, if we're looking at judicial precedent, if we're looking at trends, even the Fifth Circuit, the most banana circuit, arguably, rejected this argument that there is no private right of action. So what we're looking at is an argument that is essentially made from whole cloth, and it's a thinly veiled attempt to basically just render the Voting Rights Act a relic of the past.
And the evil of this Arkansas decision that says there's no private right of action is, everybody note this, that of the 50 states of the United States, that seven of them now have a different rule when it comes to being able to directly sue under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And that's why it exists, to stop racial discrimination in voting. But if people try to do that in the following seven states, in Iowa, South and North Dakota, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, or Arkansas, if you attempt to do that there, your case will be thrown out. You got to have additional arguments, try to plead under, you know, Section 1980. Three, you got to, you know, look at, you know, other ways of getting your case before the court. And that includes cases where, you know, one of the more vicious cases that we're aware of out of the Eighth Circuit involves a noose, everybody, that was hung at a polling site to discourage black voters. Because, you know, that's, remember, we're talking about Missouri, where they definitely lynched black people. And, you know, they absolutely did this. And that case right now is being challenged. They're trying to dismiss it because of this evil Eighth Circuit ruling. But there are at least 27 state attorney generals who have said that this should be the law of the land. That means, folks, that you're not, your taxpayer dollars are being misused to deny you your voting rights. This is just so unacceptable. But there's good news, right, Maureen? There's some good news. Why don't we talk about the states that are stepping up? Because people like our audience are stepping up and are saying enough is enough. We need better laws. Why don't we talk about the state voting rights movement?
Yes, absolutely, Barbara. And, you know, one of our really great panelists last night brought up Minnesota's Voting Rights Act. And Minnesota's a great state with a great attorney general. Shout out to Keith Ellison. But, you know, Minnesota recently passed their state analog of the Voting Rights Act. And basically, what it does is it provides Minnesotans, particularly Black, Indigenous, Minnesotans of color, with really necessary protections against racial discrimination in voting. It really helps ensure that they can continue to make their voice heard at the ballot and elect the representatives of their choice. And more specifically, it provides that Minnesota voters do have a private right of action to sue against racially discriminatory voting policies. So any argument to the contrary is not going to fly. The state analog also protects voters from vote dilution to ensure that they are adequately represented in the state legislature. It also makes it easier for those voters to fight discrimination in court through collaborative non-court processes. And lastly, I think it requires courts to interpret all election-related laws in favor of the voters and their equal right to participate in the political process, which is a sea change when we compare the Minnesota Voting Rights Act to a decision like Shelby, which places almost an inordinate amount of power in the state.
Well, and Maureen, your folks are listening. They're like, okay, so there's this federal legislation that's pending that is not being passed, and the states now, or some of the states, are picking it up on their own to try to pass the state version of that federal legislation in the individual states.